From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, a discussion about various hotspots in the Middle East and the challenges they pose for U.S. policy. Our guest, Ellen Lapson. She's professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and that's a college based in the nearby state of Virginia. After a distinguished 25-year career in the U.S. government, Ellen Lapson became CEO of the Stimson Center, a nonpartisan policy group and research center based here in Washington. Prior to taking the helm at Stimson, Ellen Lapson served in a number of prestigious senior positions within the U.S. government. She was vice chair of the National Intelligence Council. She served on the State Department's policy planning staff and worked with the Congressional Research Service. Ellen also served as a member of President Barack Obama's Intelligence Advisory Board from 2009 to 2013. We'll talk with Ellen Lapson, a seasoned national security analyst with expertise in the Middle East, about the many challenges facing the region, including Syria, Iraq, Iran, and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as well as the implications of how the Trump administration is choosing to deal with these myriad issues of great consequence to the United States and the world. Ellen Lapson joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carol. It's good to be with you.
Well, Ellen Lapson, first to Syria, where we witnessed a devastating chemical weapons attack last week in Douma near Damascus, allegedly perpetrated by the Bashar al-Assad regime, which is strongly backed by Russia and Iran. Now, President Donald Trump has blamed Russian President Vladimir Putin and Russia, as well as Iran, for enabling this alleged poisonous attack in Syria, where more than 45 people have died. But interestingly, this horrific action came not too long after Mr. Trump had telegraphed that he wanted to withdraw troops from Syria. Now, in the past, of course, Mr. Trump has criticized his predecessor for doing something similar, you know, telegraphing possible military decisions involving troop withdrawals, only to find himself now doing the same thing. Do you see any kind of linkage between his statement and the unleashing of chemical weapons yet again by Assad on his citizens?
Well, of course, the Syrian conflict is actually multiple conflicts. So sometimes we can try to connect them as if they are all somehow one big complicated mess. But in fact, we have to sort of think of them each separately. I think when the president said he wanted to withdraw troops, he was in the logic of the only reason we were in northern Syria was to defeat the Islamic State, Daesh. Once that job is over, we can come home. I think that was his logic. Unfortunately, the timing of his statement is interpreted by many as giving President Assad free rein. If the United States doesn't want to stay involved, and we were only marginally involved in the conflict anyway, then they may have felt empowered or that there would be less consequence for Assad with his allies, Russia and Iran, to really use horrific means to defeat the rebels and the opposition forces. So there may be a connection in their minds. I don't think there was intended to be such a connection when the president talked about wanting to withdraw the American presence from northern Syria.
Speaking of consequence, analysts now are arguing for decisive punitive actions, arguing preferably for a unified response in coordination with key allies to punish the Assad regime and its backers, perhaps more extensive strikes aimed at crippling Assad's chemical weapons capabilities. And of course, I want to give a little context. We don't have the time to get into the many what are perceived as missed opportunities, whether 2012, 2013, 2014, when perhaps the United States with its allies could have intervened militarily and politically to perhaps change the balance of power on the ground in favor of the opposition who were defending themselves from Assad's barbarous attacks on them. Perhaps these earlier interventions might have given the Syrian opposition coalition more leverage and led to more productive negotiations to end the conflict. Maybe they might have prevented Russia from having intervened in 2015, which of course we know turned the tide of this war decisively in favor of Assad. Now I say that just to give the context, but we are where we are. Now, critics say there is more to be done than just hitting an airfield, which Mr. Trump did in April 2017 in response to last year's chemical weapons attack. He hit an airfield on an airbase, but it was quickly reconstituted. Now, Ellen, what combination of military or policy measures do you think could both punish Assad and his backers for the alleged crime, but also deter them in the future?
Well, I actually think it's too late to generate a robust American policy that would be effective at forcing the Assad regime to completely rethink its tactics. I think we don't have as much influence or leverage in this situation. When we bomb after a very specific incident of this horrific use of chemical weapons, it's a little bit to assuage our own moral conscience. It's not necessarily to change the behavior of the adversary. So I think that we have to be realistic here. There's a limited impact of these kinds of strikes. I do think that this time President Trump will probably have quite strong support from the French. President Macron is coming to Washington in a week or two, and I think there are allies that agree that we have to at least demonstrate our genuine opposition, but we should not assume that limited military strikes are going to fundamentally change the situation. The situation on the ground is that the trends in the war have been moving in Assad's favor for many months now, and the most we're talking about is perhaps punishment or moral disapproval after the fact. It's not likely to prevent the suffering of the Syrian people, which is already at a scale unimaginable in the 21st century.
Well, back to President Trump's statement about the potential withdrawal of our troops who were there to fight, as you said, Daesh, also known as ISIS, the Islamic State. Some critics say it might play well with a domestic audience, play well to Mr. Trump's base, perhaps. But perhaps the damage the withdrawal of these troops would do could outweigh any benefits. I mean, how do you see that? Do you think he's reconsidering that statement in light of what has happened?
Well, I think his military advisors have hinted that they really think it's ill-advised to pull out very abruptly. They will certainly follow orders, and if it's a gradual scaling back of our presence in the region, that might have happened anyway as the fighting against Daesh wraps up. It's so complicated between our partnership with Syrian Kurdish groups that have been very assertive and effective in fighting the Islamic State, the strong disapproval of Turkey that the United States create such a partnership with Kurdish groups, the strong assertion of Turkish power in the region by the Turks saying, we'll take care of this, we can manage northern Syria ourselves. So it's a dynamic that has to do with lots of different relationships. There's also a concern by terrorism experts that even if Daesh loses its territorial control, they've been defeated in Mosul in Iraq, they've been defeated in Raqqa in Syria, that doesn't mean that they just disappear. They may regroup, they may go underground for a while, but certainly some of the true believers of that movement are likely to still be dedicated to their cause and reappear in some other fashion. I do think there are, you know, repercussions, secondary effects of a possible American withdrawal from Syria. But it's in many ways the same story as the withdrawal from Iraq years back under the Obama administration, that sometimes what appears to be the completion of an American task and a logic based on the views of the American public, the U.S. Congress, et cetera, that it's time to come home, sometimes there are secondary effects that make us then say, oh, maybe we shouldn't have left so quickly. Maybe we are still a source of stability in that region. I think President Trump's America First agenda is premised on the notion that the U.S. shouldn't be involved in these long, open-ended military entanglements anymore. He really, not unlike his predecessor, was trying to roll back some of our military commitments around the world, and particularly in the Middle East. But the parties in the region still want an American presence. They still see an American presence as having a stabilizing effect.
And as you alluded to, perhaps it could be actually inimical to U.S. interests to withdraw these troops because we have not quite finished militarily defeating Daesh, ISIS, let alone its ideology. And wouldn't that also seed the ground even more for our adversaries, Moscow, and particularly, in the view of the Trump administration, Tehran, and also harm our ally, Israel?
I think it's quite a long time ago that we ceded Syria to Russia and Iran. I think in the early months of the Trump administration, when he was hopeful that there would be a very constructive relationship between the United States and Russia, he thought that that was a very nice kind of division of labor, that let the Russians take the lead in Syria, we'll be prominent in other conflict zones. So early on, I think the president had signaled that Russia had already demonstrated that it had a bigger stake or was more willing to commit to bringing stability to Syria. Only later did he understand that there was actually a very profound divergence of interests and objectives between what the Russians were hoping to accomplish in Syria and the United States. In addition, Iran has been an important backer of the Assad regime now for several decades. It was the Assad regime, the only Arab country that supported Iran during the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. So this has been a strategic partnership that's existed for quite some time. There is talk of whether both Russia and Iran are feeling a little bit overextended in Syria, whether their own domestic politics doesn't like the number of casualties they're taking. It's not necessarily an easy task for Russia and Iran, but they are certainly pursuing their own interests in Syria in ways that, as you said, would be inimical to American interests. But, you know, it's been more than a decade now that we have chosen to not place Syria at the top of our priority list.
And, of course, we see the consequences
yes.
of that.
But I should say that no one should be under the illusion that there's an entirely military solution to Syria. So the United States has been active as a humanitarian donor. We've been very active working with Syrian refugees and internally displaced. It's not that we're not involved in some fashion, but we are certainly not contesting anymore the Assad regime's control of the useful Syria, as they say, which are the major cities. And, you know, we are not actively pursuing a regime change strategy in Syria. We are trying to help the Syrian people, but we are not committed to trying to find a military solution to this conflict.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Ellen Lapson. She's director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, a well-known national security and Middle East expert. Ellen previously served as CEO of the Stimson Center, and that's a distinguished think tank based here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab at our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a shout out to longtime listener and Facebook fan, Mark Versteeg from Duras, Australia. If you want to hear your name on the air, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Ellen Lapson from George Mason University. Well, Ellen, let's take a look at the nexus between domestic and foreign policy. We have quite a bit of a cabinet reshuffle here recently. We have a new national security advisor, John Bolton, quite a hawk. He formerly served under the George W. Bush administration. He replaced General McMaster. And last week, Mike Pompeo was on Capitol Hill for hearings to decide whether or not he will become the new Secretary of State. He's the CIA director. So I'd like to get your sense about the composition of the cabinet now vis-a-vis the Middle East and these challenges that we face.
Well, I think that we should be careful to not overstate the personal histories of both Pompeo as the new Secretary of State and John Bolton as the National Security Advisor. They were selected in part because they were somewhat in alignment with the president's own worldviews, and that the president has now reached a level where he wants to move aside anybody that is trying to restrain him. So it's really the president's lead, and these two gentlemen more reflect what the president is trying to accomplish. He's looking for people that will be loyal to him, that will understand his agenda. And so there is a worry that we're going to face a period of perhaps more belligerent or bellicose American policy, but that's coming from the president, not from these two new appointees. They will validate, perhaps, and reinforce and help him implement those policies. I think we want to be careful, though, that the president is using his own understanding of American military force and American power not necessarily to start new wars, but to coerce and intimidate and deter America's adversaries. So we shouldn't assume, even though we've read things that John Bolton has said in the past, et cetera, that it's going to be missiles flying over Tehran anytime soon. That's not necessarily how this new team is going to approach Iran.
Well, let's go right to Iran, since you mentioned that, because we are going to discuss that, because the Iran nuclear deal certification is coming up in May. Now, with the appointment of John Bolton as National Security Advisor, who has been an unabashed opponent of the Iran nuclear deal signed by the P5+1, also known as the JCPOA, he has shown his opposition to that, as well as Mike Pompeo, should he be confirmed as Secretary of State, not to mention President Trump's longstanding skepticism about this Iran deal. Do you expect that the United States will indeed withdraw from or abandon the JCPOA? And if so, what do you think will be the consequences?
So if I were betting, I would say the odds are that we will change our status with the agreement. The president may not like a sort of shades of gray solution, which is that the United States unilaterally imposes new sanctions, but we don't try to formally kill the deal. That's possible. The president has taken these sort of intermediate steps without going all the way before. I think it's more than 50% chance that he wants to go all the way and say this deal was never good enough, in my opinion. But there is at least some chance, I would say maybe 30 to 40% chance, that between European diplomacy, the views of Secretary of Defense Mattis, the views of many other national security experts, that the president will be persuaded that given the crisis in North Korea, he should be careful to not throw away a nuclear nonproliferation agreement while he's trying to negotiate a new one, denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. So I think there's still some chance. The Europeans are in town now. I think the Europeans are pursuing a strategy that would be, how about we impose tougher measures against Iran for things that are legally outside the agreement, such as Iran's ballistic missile activity, perhaps Iran's support for Hezbollah, Iran's behavior in the region, things that were never formally part of the agreement but would look like a toughening up of policy. I think the Europeans have concluded that renegotiating the actual agreement by changing the deadlines, changing the time frames, increasing the severity of the inspection regime is simply not feasible. So I think they are hoping that they can persuade President Trump that they've made not only a good faith effort, but a real effort to tighten the punitive measures against Iran and still keep the JCPOA intact.
Well, I think you make a very excellent point, because one could have always made that argument that you can have your JCPOA and still be tough on Iran at the same time with respect to its aggression in the region. There was never really any kind of contradiction there.
Well, no, I think the president had been told as a candidate before he studied it in great depth that we gave too much to Iran in this agreement. If you talk to the proliferation experts around the world, including the IAEA in Vienna that is conducting the inspections, they said this is the toughest inspection regime they have ever had to implement. So that Iran is actually beyond what are the normal standards of surveillance cameras, non-announced visits to nuclear sites. They have shipped out, thanks in part to the Russians, nearly all of the spent fuel. They have disabled reactors. They have complied with what was really seen by many people as an exceptionally tough non-proliferation treaty. And yet, in the president's view, it wasn't tough enough. I think we have to be practical that a diplomatic negotiating process is not the same as militarily defeating a country in war. Iran was still trying to negotiate that it would be in compliance with the non-proliferation treaty, but we were not treating Iran as a defeated party. So I think that the agreement, nonetheless, is quite a diplomatic achievement.
Well, in that regard, something you alluded to earlier with respect to what signal this sends to North Korea should the United States withdraw from the agreement. Because as you said, many believe that this nuclear agreement has made the world safer, and that by withdrawing, America could undermine its reputation for trustworthiness at a critical moment, just as potential talks between North Korea and the United States are taking place. Do you think that the United States could weaken its hand in upcoming talks with North Korea? Should Washington decide that withdrawal from the agreement is the best path?
So I'm not even sure it's in the category of trustworthiness. It just seems to be illogical politically when we're asking North Korea to subject itself to various kinds of restrictions on its program when we've shown disdain for another negotiated solution. In addition, let's be honest, we were succeeded in having the nuclear agreement with Iran before Iran had crossed the weapons threshold. That's not the situation with North Korea. North Korea is already a weapons-capable state. So the president's goal of denuclearization is even harder in the North Korean case. And you would certainly want to say to the North Koreans, this is going to be an internationally approved negotiated process, and you're going to want to comply, when we've just given them sort of an incentive to say, well, I don't really have to take this seriously because maybe the United States doesn't really mean it.
Let's move on to Iraq briefly. Iraq will have elections in May. Iraq has mostly defeated ISIS. Even if the ideology remains, oil production is up. It probably likes to characterize itself as the only Arab democracy east of Tunisia, at least nominally. How do you see the future of Iraq? How would you characterize its situation to date?
Well, I think we should be impressed with the fact that there's real politics in Iraq today. There's a lot of prepping for these elections with new political formations happening and people deciding which party they want to be affiliated with. So quietly and slowly, Iraq has created a more modern and more representative political system. We always worry about whether Iran is controlling or influencing some of the political parties. I think Iran will always have a stake in whether Iraq is a sympathetic country to them. They want to avoid being in a totally adversarial relationship with Iraq again. So there will certainly be candidates, and it's possible that pro-Iranian factions will do well in the upcoming elections. But I'm seeing some hopeful signs of people meeting in cross-sectarian groupings, more secular formations. So I still think we should be moderately optimistic that Iraq is building a new and more modern political system without political violence right now. There's still a lot that has to be done to make the Sunnis feel truly included and accepted in the new political reality of Iraq. But I think things are slowly moving in the right direction.
Let's turn briefly to Israeli-Palestinian situation. We witnessed protests along the border between Gaza and Israel. Recently, these are weeks-long demonstrations designed to commemorate the so-called Nakba, or catastrophe, as Palestinians characterize the moment when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians fled their land or were expelled during the War of 1948, which then led to the creation of the State of Israel. How do you see these protests? Are you worried about how they can escalate and how this is further complicating prospects for any kind of a peace deal between Israelis and Palestinians?
Well, I haven't been optimistic about Arab-Palestinian peace for a very long time, and I think that these demonstrations are just that periodic expression of just despair, frustration, anguish. The year 2018 has many, many historic milestones because lots of things happened in 1948, so there's that symbolism. But I think there was also Palestinian genuine distress about the American decision to move the embassy to Jerusalem, the longevity of the administration of Benjamin Netanyahu, who's been quite unsympathetic to the Palestinians, the erosion of a functioning relationship between the United States and the Palestinian Authority, the fact that the Egyptians are working more with the Israelis than with the Palestinians on trying to keep pressure on Hamas as the leadership of Gaza. So they're getting it from all sides. The morale and the esprit in Gaza is just very, very low right now. I don't think they have the wherewithal to launch any kind of sustained violent attack against Israel, but I think it's just that periodic expression of just despair and frustration. I am not optimistic that the Trump administration, even though they were confident early on that they could pull together something, I think Netanyahu's own standing and his own domestic politics has eroded. So I just see very little prospect for a serious political settlement anytime soon.
Well, you earlier alluded to Egypt's cooperation with Israelis, perhaps even more so than with the Palestinians. And that leads me to ask you about the relationship between Israel and Saudi Arabia and some of the Gulf Arab states, because we're seeing lots of behind-the-scenes talks, relations between Israel and these Gulf Arab states, particularly Saudi Arabia.
despite the lack of official diplomatic relations. Obviously, they converge on their animosity toward Iran, their worry about Iran's hegemonic rise in the region. So they have these shared interests. Where do you see this relationship going, and do you see any optimism for it?
Look, I think the Israelis are probably quite quietly pleased that they've been able to establish at least discrete political and security interactions with the big Sunni Arab countries that were used to avoid them. But it doesn't mean that anybody's ready for signing ceremonies of bilateral peace treaties or anything that will be very overt. And there is a convergence of interests. Israel is a respected security actor in the region. I think the Gulf states appreciate that Israel does its piece to try to roll back what they perceive as Iranian aggression in terms of its relationship with Hezbollah and their role in Syria. So it's an alliance of convenience. And I think we have to add to that that the Gulf Arabs seem less and less attached or sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. So in the past, the Gulf Arabs would have been pushing Israel to take a more just position on the Palestinian question, and that seems to have been lower on their list of priorities. So it's tactical cooperation. Remember that Turkey and Israel had such an arrangement for a long time, but sometimes politics gets in the way, and they don't want to take it any further than this discrete level of security cooperation.
Ellen Leibson, let's talk just very briefly about the Gulf Arab states. There's a rift between Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain with Qatar. They accuse Qatar of ties with terrorism, of cooperating too much with Iran. Where is that particular rift going? Because we also witnessed recently where the Emir of Qatar was here in the United States meeting with President Trump. The Trump administration looks like it's trying to repair its relationship with Qatar, having sided with Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Egypt and Bahrain. Where is that going?
So I think the United States does suffer from this dispute that's happened really between the royal families, the Saudis, Bahrainis and Emiratis, very much resenting, and this has been building over a long period of time, the behavior of the royal family in Qatar. We need to have these guys work together. We have very robust security partnerships with all of them, but we prefer that they coordinate so that air defense systems, for example, are coordinated for the security of the Gulf region. I do think President Trump has shifted a little bit. He's taking a slightly more even-handed position now, although there was a perception that the president himself sided with the Saudi and Emirati view, but others in the U.S. government, particularly in the Defense Department, said really the paramount American interest is to try to help these parties resolve their dispute. So I hope that will be the direction we'll be taking in the coming months.
Well, that leads me back to domestic politics here in the United States, the cabinet reshuffle, and some of the issues that are distracting the Trump administration, particularly the Russia probe and other matters. Are you concerned because for so long everyone has said that the United States is critical for any kind of whether resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? It plays a critical role, as well as its role in the rest of the greater Middle East. How do you see going forward, given the turmoil here? And at one point, Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law, was the point person for Israeli-Palestinian talks, and now, you know, he has lost even his security clearance. So there's a lot of turmoil here.
Well, I think turmoil is the right word. I think there's a lot of uncertainty about the direction of American foreign policy. But the notion that the United States was sort of less dominant in the Middle East is something that has been occurring gradually over quite some time. I think we have to recognize that the invasion of Iraq has led to, you know, secondary and tertiary effects on how the region perceives the United States, our competence, our effectiveness in trying to solve regional problems rather than create them. So I think the United States has been in relative, you know, diminished position in terms of prestige, credibility, leverage in the region, and that's been happening gradually. I think in the Trump administration, that process has accelerated a bit, in part because the president has sent very mixed signals about the level of commitment and engagement that he wants to have. To the best of my knowledge, Jared Kushner may still be trying to work on Israel-Palestine, but I haven't seen any results. They talk about revealing a plan at some point, but so far I think that these are tough times for the United States in the region, but even more importantly, it's tough times for people who live in the region.
Ellen Leibson is the professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University. Ellen, thank you for coming in and for your terrific insights about the Middle East. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.